call to order this hearing of the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. Have in materials the minutes from the Wednesday, May 2nd meeting. Would you take a second, members, and look that over? We do have a quorum. Any corrections? Senator Day moves approval of the minutes from May 2nd. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are received as approved. Senator Larson brings us Senate File 1648.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1648 is a bill that that proposes a task force be established as an advisory task force on runway safety and airport zoning. This issue, members, has been around for quite some time. The discussion about what the appropriate zoning and safety measures should be in place in our state's airports, and specifically those of you, I think everybody on the committee knows that that my district actually includes the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and that is of particular concern to me. This bill deals with that airport and other commission airports. The question, really, this issue has been hanging around for quite a while. If you go back to the decision that the legislature made in 1996 to keep the airport at its current facility, the discussion about what the appropriate zoning following that decision, the process that we had in state law and still have in state law, played out. And it's fair to say that through that process, I think there's not an absolutely unifying agreement about whether or not we have the appropriate zoning and safety measures in place as it relates to zoning and in runway safety zones. And so, members, while my original bill that I introduced and was before the Transportation Committee and received quite a bit of discussion here a couple of weeks ago on transportation, attempted to try to perhaps, if you will, take a stab at solving the problem. I think what we've been able to realize from our discussion is that we as a legislature probably are not in the position to decide what ought to occur at this point. What we perhaps could agree on is that we need to take another look at the issue, and we need to involve the experts and move forward. And that's what we have with this safety zone and runway safety task force, and something that we've worked together, a number of us, to try to involve as many folks as we can to have a thoughtful result that bases our public policy in this area on really sound ground. There's a wide spectrum of opinion on whether or not we currently have the right policy in place, to some folks that believe we are far from the right policy in place. And what I'm here to say to you today, members, is I don't know what the answer is, but I think we need to take another look. Madam Chair, I would like to move the A3 amendment. And I don't know if that's been passed out or not.
Yes, it has. Senator Larson moves the A3 amendment. This is not an author's amendment because this is not the committee of jurisdiction. So, Senator Larson, you need to explain the amendment, and we'll take discussion before we act on it.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if you look at the A3 amendment, what we do is there was considerable discussion in the Transportation Committee about the way the task force was originally drafted. Was that it was essentially or mostly legislators, largely legislators on this zoning task force. And the reason for that is that ultimately we are the body that sets policy as it relates to the process for determining what is appropriate for runway safety zones and zoning beyond runways at our airports. And so, members, it seems to me that on an issue this important, it ought to be the legislature that ultimately, with the facts in front of us, should be making this important decision about what we believe is the right public policy. After all, we're the ones that decided that the airport would stay in its current location, and we ought to be take responsibility for some of the difficult decisions beyond that initial decision. But with a lot of discussion and really what I thought was a really interesting debate in Transportation Committee, it's clear that what we need to do in the process is include more folks. There were a number of communities that were brought in that surrounded the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport that were involved in the zoning process that followed our keeping the airport at its current location. It was important to hear from those folks. Also, a number of the industry groups as well. But as we go through the amendment, you'll see that on page 2, line 4, we alter the task force to include the following voting members, and those are the legislative members of the task force. And that includes three members of the Senate, three members of the House, the chair and the ranking member of the Transportation Finance Division and budget divisions in both bodies, and the chair and ranking minority members on the state and local government committee, this committee, and its House equivalent. Those are the legislative members with this amendment enacted that would be voting members of the task force. And then in addition to that, members, what was in the original bill included the Metropolitan Council and a director of the director of the Department of Transportation's Office of Aeronautics. My original intent was actually the Metropolitan Council member would be a MAC representative, but as we've had this discussion, it seems reasonable that we would, in addition to having the MAC person, also Met Council person. So we add the list of folks on line 1.12, starting on 1.12, to the non-legislative members of the council or of the task force. And so you can see we add a representative of the Airports Commission, Airline Pilots Association, Air Transport Association, Minnesota Business Aviation Association, the FAA, and the Minnesota Council of Airports, and then again the communities that were involved in that zoning process as it relates to the discussion around MSP. We've defined that and so that that role is very clarified. And so, members, that is the amendment. That's how it would change this bill. It would bring in a lot of stakeholders, if you will, to this discussion about what the appropriate safety zone and zoning is at the end of our runways, and I think allows for us to move forward and try to find the right public policy. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Are there questions or comments about the A3 amendment for Senator Larson?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm just trying to engross this here. Are you taking out the as voting members the Met Council and the Office of Aeronautics?
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling. Yes, I think the and basically what came from the discussion in the Transportation Committee was that. I think there was a general feeling that it made sense to have the legislators be voting members, but receive a lot of input and expertise and knowledge from the stakeholders. Given the fact that we expand the group significantly with those experts and knowledgeable folks, we take the voting away from those two and put them in the same category that we have these other stakeholders in. In the amendment. So yes, the answer is yes. We do. That is one. That is a change of the amendment.
Madam Chair.
But you didn't really put them into. You didn't put them into the advisory group, did you? But you said that the MAC was going to replace the Met Council.
Or, no, they're both on there now.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, what ultimately we decided is it would be good to have both in the on the task force as non-voting members. Maybe Mr. Bodern could provide us some clarification, but I think with the way the amendment is drafted, it actually does include all of the non-legislative members on the task force that we have stated here. It just clarifies that the voting members are the legislators.
Madam Chair, I see what happened here. I was looking at the bottom listing of members mm-hmm. as non-voting members without noticing line 1.7 up there.
Okay. Is there any other discussion on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Larson, in the Rules Committee, on a task force that I bill that I had where we made a reference to 15059 with regard to per diem and expenses, it was pointed out to us by Mr. Watson that by the statement that you have here, that would bring the legislative members of this task force not into a different per diem statute than activities that are governed by the their own rules of their separate bodies. And we inserted at line 2.26, or similarly in that bill, per diem and expenses for either non-legislative members would be inserted or per diem and expenses for public members of the task force are as provided. And I wonder if you'd consider, I think probably in this instance, since there are other governments involved in a sense, as well as public members, that maybe the after the word for on line 226 to insert public members of the task force.
Madam Chair, I would move that as a friendly amendment.
Senator Larson moves on line 2.26, after the word for, insert public. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I'm now open for further questions on the bill, and also the bill will go back to the Rules Committee, and also for testimony. So if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill, we do have one person mentioned, Mr. Van Leeuwen.
Madam Chair, I'm Harold Van Leeuwen. I'm the Bemidji Airport Manager, but I'm also the Vice President of Minnesota Council of Airports. I did testify earlier with Senator Larson on this bill and expressed concerns over the direction at that time with the bill and how it potentially would affect the outlying airports. I know its focus is on the metropolitan area airports and everything. However, my caution to you all is that what you decide out of that will affect the entire state and the airports because it is addressing the zoning issue and direction. Airport managers are always out to get help protecting our airports through zoning. But what I'd like to see the legislative group do and what I'm saying today about it is don't look at the outcome of the zoning. Don't try and design solutions. We need to look at the process. The process we have in place today has matured over several years. It's gone through a recent redesign that we put out, the MnDOT Aeronautics has put out as the land use compatibility study. It lays out a process in there how we do zoning. You may not always get the answer you like, but it is a process. That's what, if you're going to look at something, look at the process you go through. At an earlier meeting, I said zoning is not just safety. It's not. For communities like my own, zoning is also an economic fact. It is a study of that you look at the safety in the realm of you identify the risk, you look at mitigating that risk, and you look at managing it. And that's what we need to do, look at a process that does that. If the process is in question, modify the process. I've got to caution you that when you get into the legislative body approving outbuildings off the end of a runway or the height of light towers or cell towers individually, you bring into question the local zoning authority in the process of airports. So you have to be careful when you do that. And with that, I'll conclude that at that point.
Mr. Van Leeuwen, thank you for your testimony, and of course that this is a task force. It is not a group that's given any kind of separate power to force people to act in any one way or the other, or to pass any kind of regulations. It is a group that is constituted to report to the legislature on a number of factors regarding runway safety. Senator Larson.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Van Leeuwen. I appreciate you raising those issues. And just for members' information, it was today that one of the lobbyists for the Metropolitan Airports Commission had raised that issue again, that some of the airport operators across Minnesota will be very interested in the work of the task force. And it was at their request that I agreed to include in the amendment the Minnesota Council of Airports. And so we want to have those folks in the room as a part of that discussion, and I think that's reasonable, and I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill? Mr. Hamill? Welcome to the committee, and if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I have listened very carefully to the discussion today and, of course, testified in the previous meetings on this issue, and a couple thoughts struck me. First of all, I understand that this is a task force that would be put together to take a look at the aviation needs across the state of Minnesota, and from my understanding, we use the Metropolitan Airports Commission System of Airports as kind of the model to use as part of this analysis. And I think that that's an appropriate course of action, and I think that a lot can be learned regarding airports and their compatibility with communities. And my hope also is that whatever is decided from this task force will be applied across the state of Minnesota, that we have a statewide safe aviation system. Secondly, I hope there are two groups of people that are not ignored or will be seriously considered as part of the review of this task force. The Joint Airport Zoning Board spent 2 years, more than 20 meetings, detailed, lengthy meetings, studying this issue, and in 2004 made their recommendation unanimously. I hope that the task force does take the time to go back and take a look at the hard work that was put in by those people representing all the communities around our airport system, and that their hard work is considered as part of the deliberation of the task force. And the second group that I think I would hope would be the U.S. Department of Transportation, the FAA. They did a complete analysis of our airport, its operation, the safe operation of the facility, before they authorized funding to be spent and plans to be developed for the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. And their work should be reviewed as well to make certain that they did not have an oversight or fail to see some flaw in their planning process that we can learn from. With that, Madam Chair, let me just tell you that MAC is prepared to participate. We're prepared to cooperate. We think we have great resources. I'm very, very pleased that Senator Larson's included us as participants in the process, and we look forward to working with you and providing whatever support we can, information available and studies and so forth as part of this deliberation.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Hamill? Senator Day.
Madam Chair, and I don't have any problem at all with Senator Larson's bill, but just a quick, like, I have three small airports in my, like, Faribault, Owatonna, and Waseca. Who does the zoning for the airports in those areas?
Madam Chair, if I may, there are probably a couple of different levels, Senator Day. First of all, you've got just federal criteria that have to be met any time that an airport is being certified and licensed by the U.S. government as a safe airport operating facility. So there are guidelines and criteria as far as obstruction clearance, runway configuration, construction standards, and so forth, including zoning off the end of airport runways across all of this country to make certain that we're not creating something that would be hazardous. So there's a federal review and a criteria. Secondly, our own state of Minnesota, Department of Aeronautics, has a criteria, and they have guidelines that they also employ or apply. They do so as a part of their normal review and so forth. And then there's just the local county with their concerns about their own zoning uniqueness that may create some concern. For example, you could have some sensitive land use near the airport, possibly in a rural part of the state, hatcheries, some sort of noise-sensitive activity that would also be taken into consideration as part of a local zoning examination. But you have all these parties involved.
Thanks.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling?
Thank you. And I heard it mentioned that this is to address aviation needs, but it doesn't look that comprehensive. It looks like it's mainly to address safety needs. And I'm wondering, and I think the previous testifier kind of indicated that economic needs and economic development are important parts of airports, of course, one of the reasons we have them. And if this is just to address safety needs, well, then we need to say that that's all it's going to do.
It does say that at the beginning. Senator Roebling says an advisory task force on runway safety, well, and airport zoning.
But
as both of those.
And Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if that is the only priority that we want this task force to address, and understand when they put a report out, then that's all they're addressing, and they're not balancing it out with the economic needs as well.
Senator Larson, your response.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Roebling. I think you raise an interesting question. I think that discussion sort of occurs all together. I think that because the nature of us deciding in 96 to have the airport stay in its current location, and given the land development just currently or what that was in place at the time, I think any discussion that you do have about safety and zoning is also clearly going to bring in the discussion about what the about the economic development concerns. Certainly that's what some of the communities will bring to that discussion. And I think it's okay to have that discussion within this task force. I think what our hope to do here, or my hope to do, is with this task force is to further engage legislative members that are appointed to this or that are on this task force to understand all of the issues that relate to the decision that we made in 96 and how we move forward with making sure that the zoning is what we believe should be appropriate. It was our decision to stay. I wasn't in the legislature at the time, but it was the legislature's decision at that time to say we're going to continue with this facility. It seems to me this is a little bit of a follow-through on that, to say that we want to make sure as a legislature that we're making the best and the most appropriate decisions as it relates to all these issues. In my case, I'm particularly focused on MSP, but certainly for all airports in Minnesota. And I think that with all the groups that we have in this task force, we really have the ability to have a really productive discussion and engage even more legislators on the issues of aviation. I mean, I think there's a handful of members in the legislature. The chair is one that is particularly knowledgeable about aviation issues. And I think we'll benefit as a legislature to draw in even more members of the legislature to this discussion, because ultimately it's our responsibility, as I see it. We're the ones that decided to stay in that location, and I'm not going to criticize that decision. That was a huge decision in 96 about staying here or completely moving operations to another part of the metropolitan area. But given the fact that it's our decision as a legislature, it seems to me it's really on us to follow through and make sure that we have everything appropriate in place.
Chair
Roebling.
And I do want to see some balance, I guess. The safest thing would be to have no airports, because there's always a risk of a plane crashing somewhere, somehow. but we also need to balance that with with the economic development and the needs of the economy. And, I don't see any business representation, any commerce chairs or anything like that on here that might bring that to the table. But I'm hoping, and I just want to express it publicly, that certainly we do end up with that somewhat balanced approach here, that we can't just say no because there might be a risk, or that we can't do something because there might be a risk, when we have to weigh the pros and cons of everything involved. So just wanted to make that public.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Roebling.
Senator Larson.
I think that's an excellent point, and I think one of the thing that demonstrates that is a lot of the discussion that, frankly, I'm happy that started to occur after the introduction of my bill originally, which would have just implemented what was in the study that came from the Department of Transportation. The Clarion study would have implemented at MSP what came out of their study for state airports. If we implemented that without any further discussion, the economic development cost of that would have been several billion dollars over, and on and on and on. I don't know that we can, even without a great deal of work, fully quantify how expensive that would be. And so it is about finding balance. There's no doubt about that, especially in this case when we have an airport sort of tucked in as tightly to a very populous region that we have in this case. And so I think it is all about balance and about us engaging in that and making sure that we feel comfortable as a legislature that we have the right balance and bringing all these stakeholders together to make that determination, or at least come up with some recommendations that we can move forward with.
Any further discussion? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, or whomever, this is not for Mr. Hamill particularly, but just a technical question. This section expires after the submission of the report is required under Subdivision 3. After could mean 2 years after. I assume it means immediately after. But if they wanted to finish up any work, if they're going to have one last meeting after the report's done, if they did anything else, if they have staff, it just strikes me that since there's an appropriation here, they might want an extra month or so after the report's issued.
Hmm. Senator Marty, I think you're correct. It should be, at least if we mean it to be simultaneous with the report, it should be upon the submission of the report. We have been looking at using that as a standard, however, another task force that, even though their report is required on a certain day, mm-hmm. if it doesn't get in on that day, we have not made the commission expire on that day. And instead, let's say they're 2 weeks late, instead it is upon the submission of the report. And you, but you make a good
closing party.
And
we just don't want it to go on forever.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, but like if per diem and expenses for task force members, if they have their last meeting the day before the report is issued, unless they have their expenses filed and reimbursed by that day, it is. So I guess unless Senator Larson objects to it, I suggest this section expires 1 month after the submission of the report. Might give them time to wrap up anything. It's a technical
thing. Offering that as an amendment?
I'll offer that, yeah.
Senator Marty moves on line 2.28 after the word expires, insert 1 month. Everybody understand that amendment? Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1648 as amended before us. Is there any further discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify further, either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1648? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1648 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
Just a question regarding that. As I recall, the discussion in the Rules Committee for purposes, and I can be corrected by this, it seemed to me that the Rules Committee decided that for purposes of this bill, it could go directly to Finance.
To Finance and then back to Rules.
And then back to Rules. I believe that was the case.
Senator Larson withdraws that motion and instead moves that Senate file 1648, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel.
I don't know that you even send it to the
Thank you, Mr. Hamill.
If we send it to Finance,
we should. Yeah.
Senator Betzel brings us Senate file 430, the omnibus pension bill, which represents the work of the pension commission this session.
Madam Chair, and
you have delete
right,
everything.
And as amendment. Members may be aware, the pension commission is a 10-member commission with our own staff. It is a 5 members from the House, 5 members from the Senate. The Senate members include myself, Senator Larson, Lynch, Mary Olson, and Worgen. And we have prepared a bill. Now, what we've done is I have introduced a number of pension-related bills. One was selected, which is Senate File 430, and you have a delete-all amendment, which basically reflects the work of the Pension Commission. And so I'll move the
You'll move that first.
1878-6A amendment as a delete-all
Senator,
to this bill.
Senator Betzel moves the H-1978-6A delete everything amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We have the delete all amendment before us then, and I'm assuming any other amendments will be now made to the delete everything amendment.
And I have a few, Madam Chair. Let me just kind of briefly go through and let me explain that the appointments were made quite late in the legislative session. We couldn't even start have our first meeting until early March, which is about the time that the deadline started looming upon us and trying to find time when the members of the House and the members of the Senate were available was challenging. And so we had a number of issues that were carried over from last year, some that were urgent that had to be done this year, some things that we, you know, just wanted to do. So we did spend quite a bit of time. But let me you should have a summary that was prepared by the Pension Commission staff as part of your packet. And this does review the major things. There's a number of articles in here. Article 1 are just is very technical corrections. It's correcting errors, omitted language. I don't really believe there's anything quite substantive in Article 1. Article 2 are a number of administrative provisions that relate to the management of the individual funds. And I do have Larry Martin, the executive director of the Pension Commission, is also here, by the way, to go into detail if members of this committee wish. In Article 3, this deals with specifically the State Retirement System's correctional plan membership. And there are, let me just give a brief explanation of what's happening here. There are a number of people who work in the corrections system, and they have direct contact with inmates. And they, you know, it's a kind of work that is usually done by people who are young and healthy, and it is not to be done by people who are getting older, because frankly, the older you get, the less likely it is you can do the work dealing one-on-one with these inmates. But there are many other people who work within the correction system or even within, say, the Department of Human Services who work with the sex offender treatment programs that work with people who are dangerous. And we try to come up with a review every year to determine those employees, you know, who have either direct contact with inmates or less direct contact, maybe 75% of the time or 50%, and we try to scale that to determine who would qualify for it's basically an earlier type of retirement. And so this is the annual review that we do in Article 3 to identify some of those individuals, you know, who have more patient contact. Article 4 is a major change, and it's a good change and necessary. There are many individuals, and you can see the extensive write-up on page 3 of the summary. We've seen a significant increase in recent years of people who are able to retire and draw disability benefits, and we've had some court cases on this. And frankly, it is a significant issue to the funds because some of the disabilities are not even directly caused by duty-related injuries. They're quite expensive, and we want to make sure that the people who qualify due to disability retirement are those that really are in need of it. And so,
Senator Betzel, I've never heard of disabilitant being a word. It's really strange. I mean, I'm sure it must be, but it's
disabilitant.
It's really a strange word.
It sounds better than disabled.
But this is something that took quite a bit of work from the funds and a lot of interest from the stakeholders and the affected the unions and so forth, and basically everybody was able to come together with an agreement as to what we have here. I don't think everybody in the whole world was on board, but at least there seemed to be a strong consensus to what's in here. Article 5 deals with a number of cases we had over the past few years where we have a number of public hospitals, most of these in Greater Minnesota, that are becoming privatized. And the trouble is you've got employees who work for these hospitals that are government employees, but all of a sudden they're now doing the same job but working for a private employer. And many of them want to at least continue on in the state pension system, even though their job is being changed. And in these cases, we have allowed that to happen, and these are just some of the more recent ones of that happening. In Article 6, many of the different plans have had a differing appeals process. If there's adverse determinations on pension issues, and we've tried to make them consistent with each other. So this basically provides for the MSRS system and TRA a uniform process for all state plans, including TRA. So the major plans, at least, are consistent in how you appeal these decisions. Article 7 is a bit of a – there's some controversy here, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. This deals with the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association fund. You may recall last year the Minneapolis Teachers Fund was rolled into the state TRA fund. There's a couple of issues that are going on with the St. Paul Fund, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. And I don't think we've quite got this issue completely resolved yet, and this is probably going to need further discussion, but I'll return to that. Article 8 is dealing with the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. This the MRF Fund is a closed fund. That is, there are no the members who were in that when it was an active fund, that has been terminated. The new employees have been are in a different fund, and so this fund mainly consists of those people who have been in that fund and their as affects their spouses. And we have issues allows the MRF board to invest some or all of their assets with the State Board of Investments, and it does some other cleanup with the MRF fund. Article 9 deals with the Minneapolis Police and Firefighters Relief Association. This deals with a surviving spouse benefit issue. The city of Minneapolis has some concerns about this. However, we did adopt a local approval amendment in the Pensions Commission so that whatever is approved here is going to have to be approved by the Minneapolis City Council. Article 10, although that corrects an error and it was caught by the pension staff, it could have an unintended fiscal impact, not to the state fund, but to locally, and that's you have a revenue note in your packets. And I'll be offering an amendment to remove this because we want to try to keep this bill fiscally neutral. Article 11 is various, just a lot of these are, there's some various retirement law changes to them. In Article 12, we have we had a couple of individual matters that dealt with single individuals that were approved by the commission. There are a couple of amendments, Madam Chair, and one was just a technical amendment that I believe Mr. Bodden can give us orally. I think we have the wrong name in the last article for, there's some folks who work for the Anoka County coroner's office, or for a medical examiner employees who they've been the work has now been acquired by a private sector contractor, and this relates to them, and I think we've got the wrong name in there. Mr. Bowden can give us a correct name for that. So,
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, on page 131, I need to change the name reference that appears on lines 6 through 9. It appears twice. In the bill, it reads Midwest Pathology Incorporated, and it needs to be amended to read Midwest Forensic Pathology, PA.
What page again is that?
That's on page 131, section 2 at the top of the page.
And Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Betzold,
yeah, I'll move
Senator amendment. Betzold, would you like to move that amendment?
Yes.
Senator Betzold moves again. Mr. Bowden.
Madam Chair and members, on page 131, lines 6 and 7, I'll just do this as quickly as I can. Delete Midwest Pathology Incorporated and insert Midwest Forensic Pathology, PA, and make the same changes on page 138, lines 8 and 9.
Does everyone understand that change in term? We don't have a page 138.
Page 131, line 8, and lines 8 and 9.
Okay. On two lines within that same paragraph, on line 6, to change it to Midwest Forensic Pathology, PA, and on line 8, to change it to Midwest Forensic Pathology, PA. Senator Betzold moves that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And Senator Betzold.
Could we have the 1A amendment distributed? And as it's distributed, I'll describe it. I don't think it's in your packet. I think it's going to be distributed. It's first of all, there's a incorrect cross-reference. It's not needed in there, the first part of it. When I talked about the duty disability language, this is language that was adopted by the Pension Commission. But when the amendment was being put together, as you have it right now, this language, for whatever reason, was not put in there. But this was part of it. It just should have been. It was a cutting and pasting error.
Senator Betzold, what is the incorrect reference?
I think that, it says page 50, lines 10 to 14, that's in line 3. There's a specific cross-reference to a PERA administrative change that's not needed because of some other actions that we took. It says page 62, delete line 45. We adopted two virtually identical provisions to the same statutory section. We only need one of those, and this eliminates one of the two slightly different versions.
So the first lines 3 through 7 of your amendment make some technical corrections, and the rest of the amendment puts in a section that should have been in there to start with.
That's correct.
Is there anyone who has a question about this amendment? Seeing none, Senator Betzold moves the 1A amendment, making technical corrections and inserting the section that should have been there to start with. Yeah. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, the 3A amendment, as I indicated in your packets, there is a revenue note, and
we do have the revenue.
Right. And what this will do would be to make the correction here so that that removes the revenue impact. I still intend to have this bill go to the Finance Committee, but this might have a local impact if the language is not corrected, and so we simply want to correct it. This is something actually pension staff recommended to us to put this in, and now that we see the revenue impact, we want to take it out.
Right. Senator Bessel, could you explain that just a little bit, what the
sure.
Why you got a revenue estimate on that?
Is Mr. Martin? He's the one.
What the provision was that triggered the revenue estimate and why this cures it.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. Back in 1987, the tax committee, or in the tax bill that year, the legislature instituted a supplemental benefit for volunteer firefighters who receive a lump sum benefit. and that was an amount of 10% of the lump sum benefit, not to exceed $1,000. During discussions on a different provision or different aspect of this benefit, that supplemental benefit is reimbursed by the State Revenue Department, and that's where the fiscal impact comes from. So the Volunteer Firefighter Pension Plan fronts the supplemental benefit, which is then reimbursed later in the year by the Revenue Department. The Pension Commission considered updating or making more current that $1,000 upper end cap, increasing it by the amount of the cost of living between the when it was created back in 1987 and currently. But that does increase the revenue exposure. The reimbursements would be higher for a large number of these reimbursed supplemental benefits. If you do the 3A amendment, this returns the cap to $1,000, the 1987 and thereafter limit, rather than increasing that limit, and would do away with the revenue impact.
Is there any controversy over this amendment, Senator Betzel? Is anybody wants to testify on it, or are all parties agreed we need to do this?
Well, it was caught by our pension staff that they thought that we should correct this in law. So I think that had we proceeded this, it might have been fortuitous to people who might have benefited from down the road, but you know, they never sought it from the Pensions Commission. This is something that we thought that we were going to correct, and not realizing that it might have an impact here. So by us taking it out, the people who never really knew it was going to come anyway don't even know that it's not coming. So we're okay with it. So
you're sure this doesn't have anything to do with the pre-69s?
So I'm sure. I know it does not. Okay.
Senator Betzel moves the 3A amendment. Is there a discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And Madam Chair, there's amendment a 6A amendment from the pension staff. And again, this is just an error in putting together the bill. We made a verbal amendment while we're considering one part, and apparently the changes were added to the wrong provision. And so this corrects where it should have been put. It's a 6A amendment.
There is an explanation, members, from Mr. Martin, attached to the 6A amendment. Do we need further explanation from Senator Betzel? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves the 6A amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
And my last amendment, Madam Chair, the A2 amendment, Mr. Bodron has prepared. This is something requested by the legislative auditor. Many times when we're looking at pension viabilities, we basically say the assets equal the liabilities. However, as you may know, the Legislative Audit Commission did look at post-retirement benefits, and this is an issue that the Pension Commission is going to be considering very soon over the interim. And the auditor has suggested this language in here, which I think is probably appropriate. It basically, you know, as we're trying to value these funds, we want to make sure the standards contain a statement, a requirement that they're not inconsistent with generally accepted accounting principles, not just the fact that your assets equal your liabilities. We want to make sure that, you know, they're not adjusting the books so the assets and liabilities, you know, come out okay. So we want to make sure they follow it. So there should be no controversy to this. It's just probably the commission would have adopted it if we would have had time to think about it, but we didn't. So, but the auditor suggested this language, and I think it's appropriate.
That was pretty bad.
Senator Betzel moves the A2 amendment. I see the
Madam Chair, do we have it?
It's in the packet.
It's in the packet. I see the legislative auditor is present. Did you wish to comment on the amendment, or just be ready for questions, Mr. Nobles? Mr. Nobles is here if anyone has questions about either the report or how this language implements one of the recommendations. Any questions? Senator Betzel then moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, before I open discussion on the rest of the bill, let me return and discuss Article 7, that is the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. Senator Pappas brought a bill before the Pension Commission, and the night that we considered, we spent, as I recall, close to an hour talking about some of the things that the fund, you know, has some issues and some concerns, and we want to make sure that we keep them on a stable course. There were a number of possible things that we could do, but Frank, and some of them involve money that we do not have. We laid the bill over, and then the other earlier this week we took up the bill, and but by the time we got to it, we were pretty much out of time. It was the floor sessions were going to start at 10 a.m. We were already at 10:15. We really did not vet some of the issues out here, and one of them we never really talked about. There's a cost of living adjustment that's in here that seems to be causing some issues or concerns with other funds. We've also talked to the governor's office. They have some concerns about it as well, too. So what I would propose to do is to leave the language in right now. I'm not entirely comfortable with it, but I'm going to suggest that the bill go to the Finance Committee, and that gives the interested parties a little bit of extra time to try to work out some of these issues and details to see whether or not there's any. The last thing I want is to, you know, have a bill get vetoed over a provision, you know, one provision of the bill. I think that there may be ways to resolve it or fix it or at least work with the things, but time is running out. The clock is running out on this. And this one needs a little bit more work. I don't have any proposed things to do here right now. I know that the funds are here, and Senator Pappas has an interest in this too, but as I say, I think we need one more stop here, and maybe we can see what else we can do on that. But that's the best I can offer at the moment, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas, would you like to comment?
Madam Chair, you know, I'm not knowledgeable enough about pension issues to understand why the other funds would have a problem with this fund self-imposing discipline upon the recommendations, upon their own, you know, recognition and the recommendations from the Legislative Audit Commission. I mean, that's what we're doing, is implementing the Legislative Audit Commission. The big thing that's missing here is the state contribution. You know, the school district is already paying, I think, over $8 million a year on our property taxpayers to help this fund. And the state, though, which controlled this fund for a number of years and never contributed to it, needs to start investing in it. We had requested $5.6 million, and in exchange for that, we're willing to hold back benefit increases to a cost of living. And then we wanted the amortization period to be extended 30 years. We don't have the money to do that. We hope to revisit that next year. But in the meantime, the funds are willing to impose the discipline of a cost of living increase only and not an increase based on investment. And that would be much more generous because this fund does very good at its investments. So, you know, I've talked to a number of the other funds. I don't understand why it's a problem with them.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like it needs another kind of bailout from the state at this point in time.
No, the opposite here.
But why would we need an investment of state funds? Because that's what I heard you say, and I'm puzzled by that and concerned about extending this out to 2038. I guess I'd like to hear a little more from the funds administrators, maybe, to talk about why we would extend. Is this the date when they would then need to be balancing their fund, mm-hmm. and we let it go for 30 years before it would be balanced?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's like a refinancing, like you'd refinance your house mortgage where you extend it out a few more years before you pay it off. Similar to that concept. But I would like to, maybe Mr. Kapler could comment about The years when the state was controlling this but not making adequate contributions.
Madam Chair and members, we're the financing.
I'm sorry, you need to identify yourself,
Phil Kappa
yourself,
from the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association, Madam Chair. The financing piece is not in this bill at this point in time. The commission wasn't appointed until very late in session and wasn't able to really give that. When they gave the question a thorough airing, the issue is the spending bills were all pretty far down the road by the time the pension commission was able to put together their bills. So there is no expenditure in this bill for St. Paul teachers. We'll be back next year requesting one, so I guess it's not a non-germane question, but there is, we're not getting funding in this bill. The rationale behind the supplemental appropriation for St. Paul teachers is that for most of this fund's existence, the contribution rates for the employer and employee going into the fund and the supplemental contributions necessary to amortize the unfunded liabilities of the program, we're controlled by the state. They're written in statute. We don't have any flexibility over that. We don't control that. This fund has had a deficient contribution because it's had unfunded liabilities that needed to be, and unfunded liabilities are really the primary responsibility of the sponsoring entity or the controlling entity over contributions because they define the benefit and they define the rate at which contributions are going to go in. An adequate contribution hasn't been made to St. Paul teachers for 45 of the last 48 years. I mean, we spend a great deal of time explaining to people why we're, in actuarial terms, on an actuarial basis of measuring the assets at 69%, market value basis at 74%. I like asset smoothing, so I prefer using the 69% number. But why are we at 69%? I think that the more interesting question is how the heck is St. Paul teachers still here? Because the fund has experienced a very, very long and protracted period of insufficient contributions. Those contributions are controlled in law and in statute. The state was actually, for purposes of financing the program, the employer of record from the period 1975 until 1987. Our fund, along with the state TRA, Duluth, Minneapolis, the employer contributions, supplemental contributions, to eliminate the unfunded liabilities in all those programs was came out of an open appropriation from the general fund of the state. So, and that was the period under which the unfunded liabilities probably grew the most.
Senator Roebling.
Now you talked about deficient contributions, and I know that there's people who control the benefits. And I'm wondering, what was the highest rate percentage rate of increase that this fund paid out in the last 10 years? How high did it get up to? Was it well above the cost of living?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, it definitely was. It was in the 9% neighborhood. I can't tell you exactly what that was. Without going back and looking at some of the history, I can dig through and find it for you if you'd like, and I can give you that information later to the details.
But, Madam Chair, Mr. Kaplan, you need to explain that that was mandated by law. They had to give contributions based on their investments. It wasn't, you know, they didn't have any choice. We're trying to change that so that they only give contributions based on cost of living, not because of how well their investments are doing.
But Senator Roebling, Madam Chair, if it was, we were mandating that they make benefit payments, even if the fund was underfunded, mm-hmm. and we were the ones mandating that, and not their own board.
You seem surprised that we would do something foolish, Senator Roebling.
Right.
Well,
that is foolish.
Well, mm-hmm. Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel, probably the wrong word to use.
Well,
like
whatever.
That,
but Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, pension funds basically are funded by the employer contributions, and to the extent we're talking about government entities, it's tax dollars indirectly. We do make some general fund appropriations to overall as an ongoing thing, but by and large they come from the base of the government agencies, the government districts, whatever we're talking about, and the employee. You know, the employees have to contribute to their own. But those rates are pretty much set in statute, and we also had some control as to what the benefits to be paid out. And what happened was that after a number of years of inflation, the benefits that were being paid were not keeping up with inflationary increases. And then we went through a period in the 1990s when the funds were doing quite well because the stock markets were doing well. The investments were very good. And so we got into a cycle where a lot of the funds and the members, you know, were pressuring the funds and the members were pressuring their legislators to say, look, we want to catch up with the fact that our pensions have not been keeping up with inflation. And so we made those adjustments. I think the problem was that the some of the increases were a bit too generous, I think. I mean, trying to keep up with them. And the fact is, you should not have a pension policy that basically says we're going to give out nice benefit increases when the times are good, because the reverse of that is when times are bad, nobody gets anything. And that's probably when people need the additional help. So one of the things the Pension Commission did, and it was a bill that I carried and was put into the pension bill, I think, a year or so ago, was to cap off how high the benefit increases can go, so that even if they have additional money, they can't just give out the benefit increases just because it's there. So we're trying to, you know, have the discipline in there not to do it. But the trouble is, once you allow some funds that may be very well funded to give out benefit increases, you can't. It's very difficult to go tell others that say, well, you're not as well funded, so your members, you know, don't get a bump where the other ones are. That's one thing you find out about pensions. Nothing's fair, but whatever you do in one area is going to pop up in some area. And that's frankly one of the issues, concerns I've got here with the St. Paul teacher's pension is that however we resolve this, I want to make sure something's not going to happen that other pension funds are going to come to us and say, well, you're allowing a benefit increase here, and it's our turn now, and, you know, help us out. So that's why we try to tread carefully.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So I'm trying to figure out what Article 7 actually does besides extending the state out 30 years into the future for a balanced fund. Is this actually holding the benefit increases to cost of living only not based on investments? So if you get additional investment funds, and you do well in the market, that is supposed to help balance this fund sooner. And yet we're still out 30 years. So I'm really troubled by that. I mean, that's a long time from now. And just wondering how we can, without a big infusion of state dollars, other funds have worked on balancing their funds sooner than this.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, if I may, 30 years for an open pension fund, open meaning one that's accepting new members, it isn't closed, is standard. We have in Minnesota a history of establishing fixed amortization target dates in statute, and what happens the instant you set that date is you start to encroach on it. You start to approach it. The idea is to try to avoid intergenerational inequities by getting one generation or cohort of employees, employers, taxpayers to finance a benefit and another to draw it. And we want to keep, in an accrual sense, we want to keep the collection of assets to finance benefits in sync with the incurring of those obligations through, in effect, payroll contributions that are required. And we want to keep that in sync with the cohorts of taxpayers who are benefiting from the services that public employees are providing. An open 30-year rolling amortization process makes more sense to me because it avoids the distortions that are created by fixed amortization target dates. But that's a separate issue altogether. There's nothing in this bill about that. What this bill does is what is customary to do when you make a significant benefit change in a defined benefit pension program, or you adopt new mortality tables, or other key economic or demographic assumptions that drive the cost of the plan, you reset that amortization target date, and you take it out 30 years for teachers and other career civil servant types. For police and firefighter-type employees, that's usually 20 to 25 years, because their expected full career of service is shorter. So we're just resetting that in effect, mortgage date, sort of. But this was done for the statewide teachers' retirement fund when you consolidated Minneapolis teachers' fund in within last year.
Mr. Rice, that's not allowed.
And so there's nothing out of the ordinary there. What this proposal does is indeed divorce the post-retirement benefit increases from investment performance. Our board and our members have agreed that it doesn't make sense to tie the two together. In fact, what ends up happening is you have the rather perverse effect when you do that of, if you think about this conceptually, when the markets are performing extremely well, generally, is when inflation and interest rates are down. That's not when your retirees are experiencing erosion in the purchasing power of their benefit. But that's when you're giving out the big increases. When inflation and interest rates are up, the markets are down. So when your members are experiencing the deterioration in the value of the purchasing power of their annuities, that's when you're not able to give the benefit increases. It's not that these things are unrelated. It's they're inversely related and directly. Our board and our members have come to the point of view that it makes a lot more sense to protect the purchasing power of the benefit the member has earned. That's in sync with the idea of providing a defined benefit retirement program. We don't just cut these people loose after they retire and let inflation and good management or bad management of the money supply by the Federal Reserve drive whether they prosper or suffer in retirement. But excess investment earnings should be plowed back into the fund to fertilize it, in effect, and reduce the cost of the program in the future, both for the members, the employer, and the taxpayers. And that's the thinking of this group. Based on at least one scenario, one could draw many. I think one valid scenario that I've worked out, it looks like we could save this fund in excess of $300 million over that 30-year period. But based on the way the actuaries do these valuations, if you just look at the effect of this proposal, it looks like it has a cost. And it looks like it has a cost because the valuation, what we're doing with the proposal is substituting a benefit change that can be costed for one that isn't presently costed. If this bill weren't adopted, there's a chance that we could give a 6% permanent compounding increase on January 1 to retirees, irrespective of what inflation is. And the actuary doesn't pick that up because they never assume that we're going to beat our targeted rate of 8.5%. They also never assume that we're going to miss it. They assume over the next 30 years that we're going to hit 8.5% exactly every year. And if I can guarantee you one thing, if there's one thing in this whole proposal that I'd bet my own money on, it's that we will not hit 8.5% any one of the next 30 years. We'll be above it and we'll be below it. And the years that we're above it, the five-year cycles that we're above it, will give away post-retirement increases in excess of what's needed to keep our members whole relative to inflation. And that cost will subsequently be picked up by the actuary because of the way they cost these things. But it won't be done in advance.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the explanation. Got a little lost in it, but I understand part of what he was explaining. But I'm wondering, you do represent the fund, and I'm assuming you want it balanced. But I'm just wondering if Mr. Martin might give us a view that would let us know if this is going to increase a state contribution later or not.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Wilbon, I did just want to remind you one thing before we hear from Mr. Martin, and that these are the recommendations from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So there has been an objective entity that has looked at the situation with the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund and has made these recommendations, absent one thing, and that is the state contribution, which the auditor also recommended.
I appreciate that clarification, too. But I'm just wondering if Mr. Martin would...
I want the legislative auditor is here. Would you like to hear from them, since they're the ones making the... We could hear from both, for that matter.
Madam Chair, whoever could answer whether or not the state contribution is going to grow or decrease because of these proposed changes.
There's no state contribution, right?
Mr. Nobles? And I think Senator Pappas' point is that the state contribution is not in this particular provision.
Right. But, Madam Chair, it'll be coming.
A proposal will be coming, but right. not this year.
That's right.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nobles.
Jim Nobles, legislative auditor. With me is Jody Hauer, who developed the findings and recommendations of our report. The one thing I would like to clarify, and I appreciate Senator Pappas making the point, that some of our recommendations are in this proposal. The one for increased contributions is not, as I think other people have said. However, just one clarification. Our recommendation was not necessarily that the state contribute. There are others that could make contributions to improve the financial condition of the fund, namely the St. Paul School District or the members. So actually our recommendation was that contributions be increased from either or city or the members. Namely, we did not recommend that the state make the contribution. Although that would have the same effect. It would bring more money into the fund. And that was our central point, that we don't believe that these changes alone, although certainly in a positive direction, namely the changes that are being proposed to you in this bill, that these alone will not get you to full funding of this mission.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Knowles, so contributions will have to be made yet to get the full funding, and from any of three entities, the St. Paul School District, the employees, or the state. And I want to know how much the contribution would have to increase if we don't address this issue. I mean, if we do what's proposed in here right now without addressing the increase in funding, does the liability grow?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling,
Nobles.
I'm going to have Ms. Hauer give you that answer, because we did actually look at how much increased contributions would have to be increased to achieve the full funding. I think the problem comes, and I'm sure the people representing Paul will tell you, that the St. Paul teachers are already making a higher contribution than is the typical of their comparable funds. But that being the case, we still made the recommendation that to get the full funding, somebody at some point is going to have to put some more money into this fund.
Ms. Hauer?
Madam Chair and members, just one point that I would add.
Sorry, you need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Jody Hauer. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. One thing that I would add to what Auditor Nobles has already explained is that given the existing date for amortization, which right now is 2021, which is when it was expected to reach full funding, there's a deficiency of about 8.7%. We recommend that there should be additional contributions. We didn't specify how much should come from the state, how much from the St. Paul School District, or how much from the teachers. We just think that the contributions should be increased to address the deficit. If the amortization date was pushed out to 2037, which I think is, it's not an unusual date, by the way. the TRA, I believe, has got in law the 2037 date right now as well, the Teachers of Retirement Association. But if that date were pushed out, that would reduce the needed needed contributions to, what was it, 2.8 percentage points instead of the 8.7. So it's essentially, it's not that the liability itself is growing, it's that the payments for that is being spread out over a longer period of time.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, if I could just point out on the handout I just passed out, written by the St. Paul School District, if you look in the top paragraph on the back, it just kind of goes through what previous efforts have been done to try to address this. Well, first of all, the first sentence in the memo says that from 1975 till 1987, it was the state's sole responsibility for contributions here that were not made adequately, and I don't really know off the top of my head what adequately would have meant. But in 1993, if you look on the back on the first paragraph, the state required an additional employer contribution phased in over 5 years from 0.5% of payroll to 3.84% of payroll. The district currently levies $5.5 million from local taxpayers to pay for the additional contribution. So the city, the school district, is trying to meet this. It's just it's kind of a difficult amount. So the district current employer contribution rate is 8.34% compared to 5% for statewide TRA. So there you have the inequities. The employee contribution rate is 5.5% compared to 5% for state TRA. And then we currently pay an employer contribution rate of 11.64%, and the employee share is 8% for our basic plan members. So, and the state has started making contributions since 2006, just started making them, and at that 2.8 million rate. So it's really not enough. We need another 5.6 million a year with this plan, and it hasn't been resolved yet because, as Senator Betzold mentioned, this came, the Pension Commission started late. So we have to resolve it next year as to who is going to pay for it. I mean, obviously the school district will ask the state to do it, but I'm sure there'll probably be some negotiations over, you know, how this is going to get paid for.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Since the payments in seem so much greater, are the benefits going out much greater than the normal plans too? Or I'm just trying to figure out why the imbalance occurred.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I think that Mr. Kaplan tried to explain that by law, they had to make their benefits based on how they were doing in the market. And they were doing well in the market. So yes, you're right. The benefits were too high. And they continue to be too high unless we make this COLA change, because they're required to pay more when the fund's doing well, and then when the fund's not doing well, they pay less. And the chart I passed out is an effort to even that out. So regardless of how the market's doing, you look at over 30 years, we expect the market to average 8.5%, and so the same thing. The benefit is going to average 2.7%. That's the extent of what I know about pensions.
Are there further questions for Ms. Hauer or Mr. Nobles, or did you still want to comment from Mr. Martin, Senator Roebling?
Well, the comments from the legislative auditor are helpful. Okay. It just, you know, points out the need that somebody's going to have to pick up the tab here, and I, you know, representing the state sitting here, it doesn't quite seem fair that we end up doing it when our districts don't get benefits like that. But I don't know. Yeah. This has a long history that I am not sure how it all evolved. And it wasn't probably some of the wisest decisions made around here in past years. But I hope we can fix it. And the sooner the better, of course. And
it seems to me that the policy that's being imposed here is a big step forward toward
discipline.
Fiscal responsibility. Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that's absolutely right, and I'm hopeful that hopefully we can get an agreement so that the governor doesn't make a veto here. You know, even though we don't have the appropriation in the bill to begin the process of making the fund whole, we're taking these steps, I think, so things don't get appreciably worse. And I think our concern is if we continue to say, or if we decide our policy is to say no, we're not going to address this, and the problem gets worse, we'll ultimately deal with it someday, and it'll be right. a much larger problem. And so I think that, and as it relates to the veto, if we get a veto and nothing happens, the net result will be that there will be a larger payment out of the fund. So the cap in here is an important provision, and so I am hopeful that we're able to work something out and we can get this done this year. As you know, the commission's attempt and the legislature's attempt to at least make incremental progress in solving the problem.
Not, Madam Chair, not leave it to the point with Minneapolis where that should have been addressed much sooner, and we're not anywhere near. Yeah, that unfunded, but and TRA couldn't handle taking another this liability, either.
Is there further discussion of Article 7?
Oh,
thank you,
yeah,
Mr. Nobles. Ms. Howard.
That page, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I actually did have a question for Senator Betzelt on another provision.
Okay, and are there any other amendments that anyone is prepared to offer? Okay. Senator Betzel, Senator Pappas has a question.
Senator Betzel, Senator Marty and I on page 119 on line 8 are very curious about the former legislator who died on March 5th, 2007, that there's some special benefit.
Sure, I can tell
for.
You. What page is that? No,
119.
Yep. This is Senator Sams. Let me explain what's happening
here. Oh, it's
here.
Senator Sams.
It's in Article 11.
I couldn't think of who it was.
Yes.
The... Senator Sam's 55th birthday is going to be in. He would have been in August. Had he been a member of any other plan other than the legislator's plan, his beneficiaries would have been able to have chosen basically an annuity.
100% optional.
100% optional annuity. Now, the legislator's plan is a unique plan. It was created only for legislators, I think, in 1978, and only legislators could have been in that plan. And actually, we closed that out in 1996. So every legislator elected since 1996 is in the state plan. Mm-hmm. Those legislators who were elected prior to 96 had the option of converting over to the state plan. Some did. I did. But I don't think there's anyone left in that plan that's under the age of 55, so it's not going to apply to anybody else. For whatever reason, with the legislator's plan, the other plans, you know, have staff, they pay attention, they make changes. This is one plan because it's only applied to legislators. Believe it or not, we have not kept up and made changes consistent with what the other plans are doing. As things come up, we do them. And as I said, had Senator Sams either been in any other plan or had he converted over to MSRS, this option would have been available to him and his family. But, it, you know, the legislator's plan simply did not provide for that. So it was crafted specifically for his family to take advantage of. And as I say, I don't think this is ever going to occur again because nobody else is under the age 55 that I can figure out that's in that, the current legislator's plan. So
it's yeah. I just members. I'm Larry Martin from the Pension Commission. This is really a question of timing rather than a new liability of the state. This is an actuarially equivalent benefit. So if it starts later or if it was not. If it started later, it would be a larger amount for a shorter period of time. It's simply going to be a smaller amount for a longer period of time because odd election can occur earlier.
Are there further questions? Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 66 and 67, and Senator Betzel touched upon this, he was talking about moving Department of Corrections and Human Services staff into the... I call it the early retirement program for correctional officers, and I, you know, I just every year I see some of these and I wonder how much contact some of these folks have with inmates, you know, like line 66.34 on page 66 there, customer services specialist principal, and I'm thinking, now how would that position? I mean, who are we considered? considering customers here. I mean, I'm just confused. The management analyst. I'm thinking of people working with inmates, and then I'm thinking of office staff people. And those people that I just mentioned sound like office staff people to me, and I really wonder about how they moved into this group. Senator Betzel.
This is one that we heard, and I who had the bill? Anyway, this
is not the same one you're thinking of.
But this was a person who ran the canteen where the inmates shopped, and so this person had regular contact with them. The Pension Commission a few years ago was quite troubled because we had all these individual bills coming from individual legislators trying to say, well, you know, I've got a constituent who also has regular contact, you know, with inmates. And these are all corrections personnel. Well, this is Human Services right here, though. And some of these are Human Services, for instance, working at the security hospitals. This one's the canteen person. And we directed that Human Services and Corrections come up with some sort of standards. They review them. They make the determinations. They come to us, and that's what they did again this year. They looked at every one of these positions, and they came to us and said, based upon the criteria that you've required us to establish, you know, these are the ones. And this person had daily contact, you know, with inmates. Mm-hmm. Or in this case, I guess it would have been patient because it's Human Services.
Madam Chair. Just wondering, as we move people into this early retirement program, and now, is there a contribution that is greater from these employees and employers for that benefit? And if, say, they've already been working in those positions for, you know, 15 years, but that those contributions haven't been made, and now they're being moved into those categories, how much of a drain is that on the fund, or how does the fund make up that difference of people who now will get to benefit from that early retirement program but haven't paid in the past?
Mr. Martin?
Yes, members. The first question is there a differential in contributions for ongoing service? The numbers I'm going to give you are from 2006, the last valuation. There are increases that are phasing in for both of these programs, but to give you a sense of the differential, for the regular state employees pension plan in 2006, the contribution rate was 4% of pay. For the correctional plan, it was 5.69% of pay. So there is a differential. There's also a larger employer contribution because this is a quasi-public safety plan. When back service is permitted, when prior service credit from the general plan is permitted to be transferred, and this bill does do that, it does permit for individuals being transferred during 2007, and it also catches up for some individuals moved in 2006. They do move over the prior contributions that were made to the general plan. They also, the employee makes an extra contribution, which is the differential between the contribution rate they actually paid and the contribution they would have paid if they had been in the correctional plan plus interest. And that's the traditional way that we do that. And for this set of transferees, we're continuing that practice. For all future of the transfers, the language that starts on page 68 of the bill, it's actually specifically page 70 and 71, does handle the issue of post-2007 transfers, and there will be a larger amount transferred by both the member and the employing department. Ultimately, the full actuarial value of the additional benefit obtained by moving that past service will have to be paid split between the member and the employer. The likely consequence of that is there is going to be less interest in moving from one pension plan to the other plan, especially for long service employees.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions on Senate File 1978?
Madam Chair, I know there's a lot of folks that here who may have an interest in it, and I suppose if public testimony is allowed, that to be done since it's the first step. However, the Pension Commission heard a lot of testimony.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify either in support of or in opposition to Senate file 430. Senate file 430.
Madam Chair, let me point out one other thing.
Well, I'm looking around to see if there's anyone who wants to testify, and I don't see anyone.
I will point out one thing that's in the bill that is causing issues in the other body, and it may come up here, and I want the opportunity to discuss it with this committee. It's on the bottom of page 90. The 2005 special session in the Jobs, Agriculture, and Energy or Environmental Bill, that was in a special session. And just before the bill was closed up, as I understood it, they put a pension provision into that bill. And it wasn't caught because the bill didn't have to go to the Finance Committee. When it was taken up on June 30th, we were told we had to pass the bill, couldn't change a comma, couldn't change anything because of the skate parks were going to close that day. We couldn't delay the bill, and it was passed. But there was a pension provision in there, and it related to the family of a service member who was killed. I think it was Iraq or Afghanistan, mm-hmm. one of the two. But anyway, relating to Sergeant Day and his wife, Amy. And what the provision that was put in that bill basically defined any military's member's death as being in the line of duty. And you can see that page 90, line 29. That was the language that was put in there, which meant that even though this individual was a police officer from St. Louis Park, he was deemed to have died in the line of duty, even though he was died as a soldier, which meant that his family could then collect not only the death benefits from the pension fund, which, by the way, totals, I believe, it's going to the actuary values about $2 million, but also the value of his death from the federal benefits, which is also considerable. And the Pension Commission couldn't quite see why you could have two different statuses, both, you know, it's one thing to be killed as a police officer doing job as a police officer, or to be killed as a soldier. But to have one death and be classified as both, that's how it was classified here. But anyway, somehow it's been perceived that if we repeal this, this is going to be somehow hurting service members, and it is not. Now, there's nothing we can do or propose to do or anything to change Sergeant Day's family. I mean, that's in, it's locked in, it's going to continue. But we feel a responsibility to at least go back and make sure that we change this part of the law because, frankly, there are members of various pension funds in the state who are in the National Guard, who are in the reserves, and they're being deployed. There's a number of them over right now. Some are police officers that have got deployed. Some are not. But where do you draw the line and say, well, if you happen to be a police officer when you're deployed, you're going to get the benefit that we put in that law, and if you weren't, you're not. Well, we may have to wind up covering everybody, and the funds don't have that kind of money. So we did come back in there and revisit that to try to clarify this language and so forth, but there may be attempts as this bill moves through the process to say we got to take care of our military, and unfortunately this is not the way to do it.
Senator Bessel, that specific case you mentioned, however, is not affected by this.
This is not affected by it whatsoever. That one has been done, and we're not proposing to change that. However, the funds are quite concerned that there will be other cases, and the funds just haven't got the money, especially when you consider that this was done for a person who was a police officer. And that's what the law, as it reads today, only applies to the police and firefighters. But what do you do? Don't you have to give the same treatment to other people who weren't a policeman or firefighter, but they also got just as killed? They get deployed. It raised a huge issue. And the Pension Commission never supported that change. We've been trying to go back and correct it since then. And that is in this bill, and I just want the committee to be aware of that.
Okay. Are there questions or comments? for Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, if there aren't any questions or nobody else wants to be heard, I move that Senate File 430 as amended, the recommend to pass, we refer to the Committee on Finance.
Okay, have you, you've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 430 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Is that it, Madam Chair? Are we done
I'm
for the
sorry.
Year?
There being no further business, we are adjourned.